everyone, and welcome to another Scots Wehey podcast. And today, I'm joined by writer AJ Close to talk about her latest novel, What Doesn't Kill Us. Hello, AJ.
Hello.
So can you tell us about What Doesn't Kill Us, a kind of summary of what's going on in the novel?
Well, there are two central characters, one of them white and one of biracial heritage. Liz, who is the white working class police constable, is assigned to the huge investigation to catch a serial killer of women. This is the late 70s. Obviously, there are echoes of the Yorkshire Ripper, but, you know, it was quite a touchy area, so there's nobody in the book who exactly corresponds with anybody from the Yorkshire Ripper story, not the victims, not the killer, and not the detective. So anyway, there is a serial killer of women. Nobody knows his identity. People are frightened, very frightened, women particularly. Yeah. The police are convinced that he's only targeting prostitutes, but most women have a feeling that this isn't the case, and indeed it turns out not to be the case. Mm-hmm. So Liz is assigned in a very, very junior capacity as a CID aide. She has a partner, D.S. Moody, who also has a bit of a glad eye for her. Mm-hmm. And she's got a violent partner at home. She ends up, by accident, really, meeting a group of feminists who live in Chapeltown, in the Chapeltown area of Leeds. And they ask her along to one of their consciousness-raising meetings. Mm-hmm. And she has never been to anything like that before. It's completely out of her ken. She doesn't really even know any middle-class people. And as chance would have it, she turns up with a black eye. So no prizes for guessing how she got that. And they say, look, it's not safe for you to go home. Come and live with us. So that's the basic scenario there. It turns out Charmaine, who is the character of biracial heritage, who's a little bit younger than Liz, who's an art student doing a foundation year at the Polytechnic. She has joined, again, through a series of accidents, she's joined this consciousness-raising group. Mm-hmm. So, and everybody in the book, really, all the women in the book are hyper aware that there's a man out there killing women. That makes it sound quite like a conventional crime novel, and I certainly borrowed from the, you know, the propulsive elements of the crime genre. But actually, I'm not interested in Peter Sutcliffe, the man, the Yorkshire Ripper. What I am interested in is the reaction to him, which I saw it firsthand because I was in Sheffield in Yorkshire in the late 70s and turn of the 80s. And I feel Sutcliffe was a stick that stirred up all this sediment, really nasty sediment. He didn't create it, it was already there. And that's what interests me. So you see one side of it in the police and particularly in their attitude to young women like Liz, and the other side of it you see in the feminist all-female household, a separatist household, where fear and, you know, a dislike of what men are doing generally has sort of become much more extreme, and they are more or less man-haters.
So why did you want to write it? Why did you want to kind of examine that period and that in particular?
Well, a lot of it is because, I mean, as I said, I was there. I was at university elsewhere, but I used to come back to Sheffield. And then I graduated in the middle of 1980 and came back to my parents' house, which was empty because I had nowhere else to live. So I was single. I couldn't afford a car. I was on the dole, in fact. So I would go out to meet friends. Mm-hmm. And when you were out after dark, which really meant any time after 4 o'clock in the winter, you were frightened. I was frightened, you know, and all the women I knew were frightened, in fact. You know, it didn't matter whether you were walking the streets, you know, looking around, looking over your shoulder, because there were rumours that you never heard him coming up behind you, you know. So, or you could be on a train, and because the police wouldn't say how he killed his victims, but his nickname was the Ripper, you know. So people thought, right, he's a working man, he works with tools. So anyone with a tool bag or in a boiler suit, you were thinking, is it him? At the same time, you didn't really know, because everybody, middle class or working class, had a toolbox at home.
Yeah.
So in a very real way, every male who was out there, you thought, it could be him, you know. So I lived with that. It's funny, it's such a different time in so many ways.
Yeah.
And in other ways it isn't. I mean, I was a feminist then. I was a more extreme feminist probably then than I am now. I was very, very aware that men in a pack were threatening. Mm-hmm. I made exceptions for individual men who I went out with or who were my friends. But often enough, I'd see them with other men and I'd feel that they'd changed. That, you know, but when they got together, they were on one side and women were on the other side, you know.
That sense of belonging kind of is in the book as well. That sense of, where do I fit in? I mean, it, you know, you've mentioned class, and class is a big thing there too. Both your central characters are kind of trying to work out where they fit in. And that's interesting as well. You've got people saying, well, whose side are you on? Because at the time, it was often referred to as the Battle of the Sexes, wasn't it? Uh-huh. The kind of that terminology was there, and it was almost like you had to be on one side or on the other. And that comes across in the novel. And do you think that has changed, that kind of, you know, strident lines of, you know, you're either for us or against us?
Well, it's changed for me because I've got older and because all the people I know are older.
Yeah.
How far it's changed for younger women, I'm not sure. You take an event like the rape and murder of Sarah Everard by a serving police officer, and women's reaction to that, the huge number of women who mounted that vigil, which the police insanely tried to stop because they, you know, thought it contravened lockdown. You know, they felt very, very strongly that there's still two sides. I mean, it might not be that all men are on one side, but they still felt that some men are on the other side.
And you mentioned that the Peter Sutcliffe case in Yorkshire at that time stirred up things that were already there, you know, that maybe were even unsaid at times or were said at times. And that was happening through the whole country, wasn't it? I mean, yes, something like that. In Glasgow, you had Bible John. I think similarly, people had a bogeyman figure.
That's
but
right.
What that bogeyman figure did was actually accentuate the kind of fears that were there perhaps all the time.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I talked to a lot, when I was writing this, I talked to a lot of women in Leeds, including two members of this group, the Leeds Revolutionary Feminists, who are the sort of inspiration for the feminist group. I mean, I stress, they're not the same in the book, but they did form the inspiration. They said to me in Leeds, you would, you know, you would go out on your own and there'd be men shouting, what are you doing out on your own? You know, that feeling of, you know, it's a sort of joke, you know, you shouldn't be out here because somebody's going to kill you. Sometimes that would spill over into, how do you know I'm not the Ripper, darling, you know? I mean, what I found was not quite as extreme as that in Sheffield, because he hadn't killed in Sheffield, although it turned out that the police were watching the red light district in Sheffield in the same way as they watched it in Bradford and Leeds and other places in Yorkshire. And indeed, Sutcliffe was caught in Yorkshire, just a mile from my home. But yeah, you got, I mean, there were jokes, you know, there were a lot of jokes. And there was a certain feeling of, are you scared? You know, that might be quite a sexy turn-on thing for some men, if you were scared, you know. Yeah, so I mean, it was a very different time. There was a lot of stuff women put up with which they just wouldn't put up with now in terms of harassment at work and the sort of things that you got told to do. I mean, stupid things. Like, I remember in my first job, I wore trousers, smart trousers, to work, and my manager came and told me, no, it's a skirt.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, why? But generally, there was, you know, and the adverts everywhere, the television, the, you know, this was the era of Benny Hill. It was the era of, you know, my mother-in-law, and I'm not saying she's ugly, and all that stuff. There was a very strong sense that if you were a woman, you better be a pretty woman, you know.
And you had to take a joke.
And you had to take a joke.
Yeah, no matter what it was. It's interesting because reading the book, I mean, so I was born in 1970, so beginning, you know, going to school, and as you say, being in groups of other guys at times and whatever that may be, you know, and then starting to go out, go to pubs and all of those things. And it was interesting to think back on those times and things like adverts, even right into the 90s and noughties. I mean, page three now seems like, you know, another century, but, you know, these were stars and everything. It's really interesting to reflect on how those times were just so ingrained, those mores, those kind of attitudes that people probably didn't even think about them most of the time. It just was.
That's right. I think, and I'm not saying this was wholly working class, but it was very, very bound up with working class culture. So there was a sort of element of feeling if you were middle class and you attacked those things, that you were just a snob, mm-hmm. you know. So that was a complicating factor. Not that middle class men were exempt from any of this, but it was often couched slightly differently, you know.
I think the attitude in terms of education is interesting as well. So as you say, you've got Liz, a working class young policewoman, and then she's often hit with a lot of theory, a lot of feminist theory, and you know, and that trying to marry that with her experience of life. You've also got Charmaine, who has some awful lecturers, you know, and the way that they try to push their ideas, and they go, you should be thinking this, and the real experience is something very different. Is that why you wanted to have these two as your kind of narrators? Because they're both from kind of different backgrounds, but through them we start to see the wider picture.
Yeah, there's part of that. I mean, one of the ways of looking at the book is that it's the story of their friendship.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's probably the first book I've written where there's no love story element in it, but there is this friendship between them, which happens very, very slowly. And builds, and at the end of the book you're left with a little clue that it might have lasted a long, long time.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, I think, what do I think? I mean, I wanted, with Liz, I was doing something very specific, which was, it was an experiment in voice. I mean, you can tell I haven't got a Yorkshire accent, but I mean, I went to school in Sheffield all my days. I was surrounded by, I had a mother who thought it was very, very important to speak the Queen's English.
Yeah.
And for the sake of peace, I complied. So, but that voice was always inside me. So I wanted to write a book. I mean, it's not just the dialogue, as you'll have noticed. I mean, the bits from Liz's point of view, the exposition as well, is written largely in her voice. So
yeah.
It's in a Yorkshire dialect. I mean, I tried to minimise the phonetic spellings because I think that alienates readers. But so it was an experiment in voice. And when I'm writing, I read things aloud. And my partner jokes that he feels like he was living with Liz and Bev for 2 years and he misses them now. Where have they gone, you know? So and Liz is not well educated. She's nobody's fool, but she's not well educated. And she's got the guts to say, I don't know what you're talking about,
yeah.
when she doesn't understand a fancy word or a concept, you know. Charmaine is the other side of the working class. I mean, certainly for most of the book, she doesn't really feel she's a black woman or biracial. That's entirely irrelevant to her. As far as she's concerned, Her mother is white. She never knew her dad. And what she's interested in is being an artist. So she's very, she reads the posh papers, you know, she goes out and spends her pocket money buying the Observer. She wants to, her fantasy is to go to London, where she thinks it won't be anything like Leeds, and nobody will look twice at her or mention her skin colour, and there she can be an artist. So, and that, you know, so I wanted to show two, I mean, I knew a lot of working class kids at my school. There were 1,600 kids, and they bussed them from all over the city. So it was a real melting pot. And I wanted to show both sides of the 70s, I suppose, both sides of working class life in the 70s.
Yeah. And you mentioned, you know, you didn't want to include anyone that would be thought as being involved in the time, whether it was in the Ripper case or anything kind of surrounding it. So was that easy to avoid? I guess that's what fiction is. You start to write different things. But you wanted to make it clear enough that there were links, but then, you know, not have any real people in there. I mean, you talked about research. Was that kind of an important part of it?
It was. I mean, sometimes I think I do too much research. It's because I was a journalist for so long and I really enjoy it, you know. But, I mean, people are still traumatized. There are, it's close enough. I mean, it is within living memory.
Yeah.
You know, many of the victims have family members still around. I mean, there was somebody I heard, this is a story I have at second hand, but that one of the relatives of a victim went to see a play at the Leeds Playhouse called There Are No Beginnings, I think. And he knew what it was about. That was why he was there. But they used a piece of actual audio from the local radio report of his mother's death.
Right.
And when he heard that, he completely freaked out. It was enormously triggering for him, you know. Now, I heard about that before I wrote the book, and that was quite useful to me to make me think, you've got to be really careful here, you know. So there's that element. On the flip side, the real Leeds Revolutionary Feminists and the group, which was probably inspired by them, but we don't know because they're anonymous, the group Angry Women, they left a lot of archive material at the Women's Archive North in Leeds. And I was able to look at a lot of it, but I had to sign clear undertakings that I would not reproduce certain material. It's very stuff that was written for women's eyes only.
Right.
As far as they're concerned, that still goes.
Yeah.
You know, never mind that it's 40 odd years later. Mm-hmm. The situation is complicated by the fact that Angry Women firebombed a large number of sex shops across Yorkshire.
Right.
They didn't hurt anybody. They were, but nevertheless, arson, which is fire setting in England, carries a life sentence potentially. Nobody was ever arrested, as I said, but, you know, I had to be very careful. I did want to write one of my characters, at least more than one of my characters, as part of that group who were setting fire to sex shops. So again, you have to be really careful not to finger anybody, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I'll just quickly say something about the Leeds Revolutionary Feminists,
sure.
Because they have been credited with breaking the women's liberation movement in Britain. They were quite extreme separatists. They were very, very early campaigners about male violence against women and making the streets safe for women and refuges and rape crisis centres. They brought out a book called Love Your Enemy, which, you know, depending on who you ask, was partly a provocation, partly really meant. But they introduced, that book introduced the idea of political lesbianism and said, you don't have to sleep with other women, but you have to stop sleeping with men.
Yeah.
You know, men are the enemy. If you're having them in your house, having sex with them, you are giving succor to the enemy, and you can't be a feminist under those circumstances. And that caused a lot of trouble in the women's movement in the UK, with feminists who, you know, really put in their time, but who happened to be married or have a long-standing boyfriend, you know, feeling quite angry that suddenly they were seen as traitors or quislings. And by the same token, quite a lot of women decided, okay, I'm going to do that. I'm going to become lesbian in every sense of the word. So there were a lot of women who started sleeping with other women who had not hitherto been lesbian, and women who saw themselves as lifelong real lesbians, in quotes, took that amiss, some of them.
Yes,
did.
I can imagine.
Yeah. So it was an interesting time, you know.
Yeah.
And then you've got the other, this is talking about the characters in my book, not talking about the real people here. You've got that interesting thing that, yes, women are all on the same side, but that doesn't mean all women are likable. You know, I mean, there was something feminists said a lot, you know, I may not like you, but I'm still fighting for your rights. And when you've got, when you take men out of the power equation, there's a vacuum which, you know, quite often a woman will fill, or more than one woman will fill. And that's what happens in this all-female household in the book. This woman, Rowena, arrives, who's a self-styled feminist freedom fighter, very confident London metropolitan woman.
Mm-hmm.
And she shifts the balance. Hitherto, the group in the house has been quite, well, they're domestic revolutionaries, if you like. They bring up the children to think that everybody in the house is their mother. There's no particular mother, and they give the children the surname Wilds because the children belong to themselves. Now, after Rowena arrives in the house, things start to shift. They start engaging in much more extreme forms of direct action. They start breaking the law. Liz is a police officer, but not out to them as a police officer, which puts her in a difficult position.
And you have, it's interesting because all those conversations that you've just set out there are had in that house. You have, you know, not everyone is saying, yes, let's go and do this. It's not one, you know, speaking as one. There are all sorts of conversations going on. And then you have Liz. That's what I meant, I think, by you get the wider picture through your two central characters, because they are relating these conversations. But you've also got transcripts and interviews as well. Is that right? You're good. I'm trying to think now. But so did the story you want to tell, did that kind of shape how you wrote it with these different aspects of it?
It did. As I think as I go on, I'm more interested in telling stories from many characters' points of view.
Right.
I used to, you know, focus on one person and their psychology. Maybe it's about getting older. But I did want to tell a story about a group of, I mean, you know, 9 women and what life is like. I mean, not all of them get equal dibs in the story, if you like.
Yeah.
But yes, I think there are other little influences. I remember going to an exhibition at in Dundee about Paul Robeson, the singer, who was tracked by MI5 or MI6 for quite a long time, and they had the transcripts of what he'd said and what he'd done, which were phenomenally banal, quite amusing, really. Obviously, enormous amounts of effort had gone into producing these endless transcripts of the things he said to people. So that stuck in my mind, and I quite like the idea of using that sort of objective, if you like, element to sort of move the story on in places. And I mean, because, of course, the police were very interested in these women, you know.
Yeah.
As, you know, subsequent events was to show.
And a lot of your novels examine moments and people in history. Does that cause you to think differently about the present day? I mean, has writing this book in particular caused you to kind of think, well, what is the situation today?
It has, but unfortunately, I don't think I can write about it.
Right.
So much of what's around is online now, particularly if you're young. And I'm, you know, I'm an analogue person. I just I don't even have a smartphone, you know. The internet is very useful for research, and I'd probably spend a fair amount of time online on my computer. Mm-hmm. But I really feel there's an epistemological break, as we used to say,
yes,
between people who lived pre the internet or had their formative experiences pre the internet and those who came after. And I can't really write about that world. It's interesting. I am writing another book now, which is set, well, parts of it are set in the early 2000s.
Okay.
Because they have to, it's all right having the internet because Google wasn't, yeah, so completely, you know, the encyclopedia of everything,
yeah,
even 20 odd years ago, you know. But it has to be pre-smartphones, because once you've got smartphones, your plots are a disaster, you know. Random events, coincidences, people coming back after years. None of that happens anymore. You can find anybody at the, you know, touch of a keyboard now.
It's so interesting. I've spoken to a few crime writers who say, yeah, I set my books in the 70s and 80s because mobile phones would kill the plot completely. You know, you would be able to find out all sorts of things about your characters. That's really interesting. And but also your novels often look at women trying to change their world. You know, it's an immediate thing. You know, is that something that you're kind of constantly interested in when you write your novels? It's these ideas, similar themes in a way that run through nearly all of them.
Yes, although, I mean, you can get to the end of it. I'm not sure I haven't got to the end of it now with this book, actually.
Right, okay.
Because it's present in Trust, the one I set, well, it's set in two times, but the first time is during the miners' strike with women working in a merchant bank. Obviously, it's present in my suffragette book, Petrol Scented Spring. To a degree, it's in What We Did in the Dark about Catherine Carswell, yeah, in the, you know, turn of the 19th, 20th century. And this one, set in the 70s, I'm not sure I can do it again.
That's interesting. Is it for any reason? Do you just think, well, this feels like the end of that investigation, sort of investigation?
It does. I mean, every writer has certain themes which, you know, yeah, fire them. But I really don't want to write the exact same book again and again and again, you know.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I never think of you as having written the same book again and again. Yeah. But there are themes in it. Yes, you see, every writer has the themes they're interested, yeah, in. But more than most writers, I think I'm always interested to see what you write next, because it's not the same as what went before,
uh-huh,
you know. And also, I should say that there's humour in this book, and did you enjoy revisiting those times in the 70s and 80s and coming up with references and, you know, just, and even some of the ideas that were prevalent at the time? Because, you know, some of the characters, some of the male characters in particular, I mean, you cringe a bit, but they're realistic, you know, the attitudes.
Yeah, I mean, I think it comes with writing about Yorkshire.
Yeah.
Because if you're reproducing working class speech, it's very, very humorous, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, you may not like the people who are making the jokes, but you understand the jokes, you can tune into the jokes. And I think that was quite helpful, writing the two main male police characters, the chief inspector and the sergeant, because, you know, they are pretty horrendous in some ways, but they are quite funny, you know.
Yeah.
And Liz, you know, in some ways is enraged by them, but in other ways is quite fond of them because she's got on with other men who speak that language. So there's some of that. I also wanted to say, I mean, people have such a penitential idea of second wave feminists, you know. Oh, they didn't wear makeup. Oh, you couldn't wear heels. Well, I have to say I've spent a lifetime not really wearing makeup or heels, and it hasn't ruined my life. But I mean, they're, you know, they're young women. They like a drink. They like a smoke of all sorts of things. They have fun, you know. And I wanted the reader to have fun spending time with them.
Yeah. It's, and do you think fiction does, when telling stories like these, it does something that non-fiction can't do? I'm thinking of kind of empathy. You know, if you're reading something that is purely factual, then, you know, it, well, maybe it's just me, but it feels like, you know, you're, it's a studying almost what went on. You can be horrified at what went on, of course, but it's a different thing. I think fiction often can carry more empathy. Do you think that's true?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I would like the reader to be able to empathise with just about everybody in the book to a degree. Even in a weird way, the least sympathetic character, Rowena, I think you can, you get glimpses of where she's coming from.
Yeah.
You know. And I mean, it's funny. I'm finding this at the moment, actually. I'm writing a book which is inspired by people I don't find particularly congenial. But I don't find you can write characters in a book without making them likeable to some degree.
Yeah.
Even if they're horrendous and the things they do are horrendous, you have to have some sort of insight into why they do what they do. And once you have that, you're sort of on their side to a degree, I think.
Yeah, and that often comes from the other character's reaction towards them. Because if everyone thought they were just wholly Rowena, but it's a horrific, then they'd be out.
That's right.
You know, even though, you know, some people do want that to be, that to happen.
So then, of course, we have a character who isn't a major character, but is the killer, the person who's killing all these women. And consequently, I just portrayed that person from the outside.
Yeah.
Because I really don't think, I mean, maybe it's possible to feel some empathy. I mean, Gordon Brown's fantastic book, Somebody's Husband, Somebody's Son, about Peter Sutcliffe, certainly did a good job of explaining why he might have been that sort of person, although nobody can really explain why that sort of person takes it so far as to kill women.
Yeah.
You know? But no, the actual killer in the book, I don't really get under his skin and didn't want to.
And you said right at the start, you've got this kind of bogeyman figure that is the conduit for all this other feelings and attitudes and all that thing to rise to the surface.
Yes. I mean, when I pretty much do transplant wholesale onto Liz. I remember when Peter Sutcliffe was caught and you saw the photographs of him. Admittedly, there was a sort of dramatic black hair which gave him a sort of gothy villainous look, but he also looked weak, if we're honest. You know, there was something about his mouth, something about his eyes. You felt in a weird way disappointed because
that's interesting.
What, you know, what you'd been afraid of was so much more powerful than this rather pathetic individual who, it turned out, used to, you know, play practical jokes with corpses when he was a grave digger, and he had a high-pitched sort of laugh that gave everybody the creeps. I mean, definitely not an alpha male, shall we say.
Yeah. Can we go back to Forspoken? That was the first book of yours that I read, because I always tell people that there was two novels that came out close together, I think, but maybe both 1998, that changed. So I was living and working in Glasgow city centre, and these were two novels that it was showing a Glasgow that I knew, and that, I don't think that had really happened before. You know, it was cafes that you went to, restaurants, you know, the streets, people, the way they talked, the way they dressed, all sorts of things. The other one is Denise Miner's Garnet Hill, was the other. And when you were writing it, were you just writing what was around you, or were you kind of, did you have a thought about previous Glasgow novels and what they were like? Because for me, they were still kind of stuck in the McIlvany, No Mean City style. You know, that's what Glasgow felt like. There's almost stereotypes that were still being adhered to, and here was one that didn't do that at all.
Yeah. I think, well, I mean, I was still working as a journalist at that point.
Yeah.
And I had given myself, I'd arrived in Scotland that long before. Well, I mean, 10 years before Forspoken came out. And so I'd given myself a crash course in Scottish literature and Glasgow literature in particular. So I suppose there was the sense of not wanting to write that, but still feeling within that tradition. But yeah, I mean, a lot of it was just, you know, living through experiences, going to places and turning them into fiction, giving them a bit of stylish topspin,
yeah,
but essentially not falsifying what was around.
No.
So it's funny you should talk about that book, because I literally have not read it since it came out. So my memories, I often think, should I read it again? I had a real sense when I was writing it of having so many ideas, you know,
yeah,
and big ideas, and wanting to get them all down, not just about Glasgow, but about things like psychotherapy and people and family dynamics. And I just remember, and superstition and the paranormal.
Yeah.
And I just remember really, really loving writing it and feeling like the biggest brain in the world as I put it all down. The reason I don't read it now is I think the writer in me that's been a novelist for 20 odd years would want to take the blue pencil to a lot of it. But I don't think you could do that without destroying the whole thing.
Yeah.
You know.
It's another one, when people ask me to recommend a Glasgow novel, that's always one of the ones at the top of the list. Because I think, especially now, you know, I read it when it came out, but now it's a historical piece in itself now. To go
Absolutely.
Back in all those times. And in terms of being a writer, you've been doing it for a while now. How has it changed over the years? You know, I'm thinking of this for anyone who's listening who might be just starting out in their kind of writing career, to see maybe how things have changed.
Yeah.
If they have.
Well, you start, I mean, it's a cliche to say early novels are autobiographical, but certainly you've got a lot of stuff inside which wants to come out.
Yeah.
So that happened with the early novels. Then if you're a writer like me, once it's out there, that's it, you're done with it. I remember talking to Kate Atkinson once, and she said, well, the thing is, what you do is you use up what's inside you, and when you've used it up, it's gone, and you feel curiously blank, she said. And to a degree, I don't know, by the way, whether she still feels like that, but it's very, very helpful to me to find a real story to be able to make a connection with, and maybe use autobiographical elements or feelings you've had, but mm-hmm. essentially you're telling someone else's story. So I did that with A Petrol Scented Spring,
mm-hmm.
and I did that with What We Did in the Dark. I have to admit, I'm finding it hard to find another absolute zinger of an idea. And so that does make things tricky. I mean, another option is going right back to a time you've never mined before, which I did in this book, in What Doesn't Kill Us, going back to the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, there is a... I used to notice, before I did it myself, that you got novelists writing, or poets, you know, rewriting the Iliad or the Odyssey or whatever it is. And I thought, why are they doing that? And I mean, now I understand. You want to catch hold of something. It's a good story that's already a good story, preferably with a ready-made plot, that you can just put your own unique stamp on, you know. I think the other thing is, I was very interested when I was younger in all my thoughts and feelings. You know, when you're in your 20s and the world is fresh and exciting, the world is not fresh anymore. It's exciting, but it's not fresh, yeah. You know. And also, you know, I mean, I sit and my friends have 20-odd-year-olds who are talking, and I think, oh yes, I used to be like that. You know, they've got so much to say and it's pouring out of them. And I think, well, that's wonderful, but that doesn't last, really. That's a phase in life, you know. So it's quite interesting. I mean, it was, in a way, it was a curse, because that's what I mean about when saying I would like to take a blue pencil to Forspoken, mm-hmm. you know, because yes, it's wonderful, you know, writing with a capital W, but you've got to have the bones of a story. I suppose that's what happens. You become much more interested in telling a story, much more interested in thinking, what's the reader thinking at this point? Are they still with me? Or have they put the book down and gone and put the kettle on and made themselves a sandwich, you know? So, that's one of the things that happens. But it's interesting because I think it was William Boyd said, every novel represents the sum total of everything the novelist knows at that particular point in time. And that's right, actually. Right. Well, it's right for me. Okay. I mean, I know there are novelists who have 5 ideas on the bubble at any one time, but I'm definitely not one of those. And so there's always, it's frightening, but when you start a new work, there's always that feeling of, have I done it now? Is that my work? You know, is there anything I have left to say? Are there people I have, you know, left to animate? Can I tell a story that will excite the reader as much as whatever book they read of mine last that they really liked, you know?
Right. So you're almost judging yourself against what you've done previously.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, you've got me into name dropping now. Russell Banks said to me, he said, you never know when you've done your greatest work, you know, your life's work. And it's true, you don't really. I mean, obviously, you look at the course of other writers, and by and large, they hit their peak and then they tail off. That doesn't mean you don't want to read what they write. But I mean, let's take someone who's not going to be offended because he's dead. Martin Amis. I mean, I don't think Martin Amis ever wrote a better novel than Money.
Yeah.
And, you know, but I still carried on reading him. But I mean, definitely the ones he did when he was a young man were his best books.
Yeah.
But you just have to hope that you're the person who bucks the trend, you know, that you're the fine wine that improves with age.
It's really interesting hearing you think that. I mean, I think Martin Amis's non-fiction actually became the more interesting stuff latterly, you know, with that. And I often think writers who have a really big first novel, that must be difficult to then, you know, go on from there, you know, if it's a really big success. And because people are always looking to that, you know, another version of that often, I think.
Absolutely. And if they have a really big success and next time around, they're just another minnow in the pond. They're not prepared for that. And it is hard, you know. It's so difficult to get published that when you the first time you're published, you think, well, that's it now. I'm going to be sitting on the underground and there's going to be people around me reading my book. That has never happened to me. I mean, never have I seen anybody reading my book, you know.
Well, if you're on the underground in the late 90s, you might have seen me reading your book. I'm going to name drop here, but latterly I was doing some work with Alistair Gray, and it's interesting you say, you know, reworking the Iliad. I mean, he was doing Dante's Inferno. That was the last things that he was working on. And I think he felt, I've told the stories. I think Old Man in Love, was that his last novel? Well, anyway, I think he felt, I've told my stories and now I'm going to do things with other things. Of course, he had his art as well that he could work on. So he did have other things to work on. But I think that's really interesting that maybe you get to the stage as a writer and you think, yeah, I've told these stories or the stories that I want to tell.
Although I'm not there yet, I am working on another
no,
one.
No, I'm not saying you are, but I just think you brought it up.
I know.
I'm waiting for your odyssey when that is, that's all. Can you talk a little bit about what you're working on just now, or would you rather?
No, I can. It's about an artist, a famous 20th century artist who's as famous for his illegitimate children as he is famous for his art.
Right.
And so the story is essentially told from the point of view of the children, not all of them, but six of them. And because you can't just have family dynamics, there's a missing masterpiece thrown in there as well. But it's allowing me to ask the question, which is interesting, which I thought about when John Byrne died, and I know you wrote about that.
Yeah.
You know, who decides who the great artists are? I mean, you can say, oh, well, posterity decides. But if they're people who are around and then die, what makes the difference between the ones who are seen as truly great and the ones who are just, Kent, you know? And a lot of it, I mean, being a novelist is slightly different, but there are echoes in the art world. You have to have a high profile.
Yeah.
You have to have a sale value on the international art market, which means you're not necessarily being bought by connoisseurs. You're being bought by investment banks and things. So that's about being famous, you know.
Yeah.
And then if you're a painter of reasonably small pictures, you have to move up to painting these really massive things that will work at the Museum of Modern Art or wherever.
Yeah.
You'll never really break through until you're making these mega things that major institutions are going to be bidding for. And again, that's if you're someone who paints small, what happens if you actually can't paint big?
Yeah.
You know, you're consigning yourself to another bracket, really. So all of that I find quite interesting. And I originally was going to base it on the life of, a couple of real artists.
Uh-huh.
And then I realised that the problem with them having so many illegitimate children is that they've got quite a few descendants around. And perhaps I didn't want to get into that mess. So, again, we're making it up.
That's, again, fiction all went through. You know, people can read into it what they want. AJ, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to me. I really appreciate it.
Well, you're welcome. It's been a pleasure.
And we'll be back soon with someone completely different.